This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. On and on it goes. The conversation at City Hall about FC Cincinnati's forthcoming stadium and its impact on the Cincinnati Ballet. That's continuing at City Hall. Where are we now? What's coming up next? We're going to talk about it. Plus, did you dodge any potholes on your way to work this week? What about mudslides and landslides? What's going on with our region's infrastructure? And where's the money to fix it? We're going to discuss that too. And if you want to weigh in on those issues, 513-419-7100. You can email talk@wvxu.org or look us up on Facebook or Twitter, 91.7 WVXU. We'll be looking for your comments and your tweets and maybe able to get some of those on the air. But before we dive into those issues, Dayton, Ohio, and Montgomery County were hit hard this week by a water outage and widespread boil advisory. And here to discuss the latest is WYSO reporter Jerry Kenny. He joins us on the phone. Welcome, Jerry.
Thanks for having me on, Michael.
So what's the latest with the water situation up there?
Well, it's subsided quite a bit. And actually, I'd like to run through a timeline of what took place on Wednesday, because it's pretty interesting. At about 6 p.m. on Wednesday, the city of Dayton sent out a notice that there was a partial water system outage affecting several thousand customers in northern Dayton and Montgomery County. That outage began around 4:30 in the afternoon. Then at about 7:30 p.m. on Wednesday, the city followed up with a request that water customers system-wide conserve water as much as possible or avoid using any water. At 11:30 that night, the city then announced that they were experiencing a significant loss of water in the distribution system, and we're talking millions of gallons of water just gone. And since there were no reports or sightings of a water main break, like flooded streets that sometimes show up in our traffic reports, they thought that that might be a break in the system somewhere under the Great Miami River that runs through downtown. That, in fact, proved to be the case. So crews worked throughout the night to find the break, checking some 1,600 miles of pipes that deliver water to Dayton and Montgomery County. And it was at that time that the city issued the water boil advisory for all city and county residents. And then early Thursday morning at an 8 a.m. press conference, they announced that they had found the break in the system, were able to isolate that section and essentially remove it from the distribution line or divert the water around it. So they lifted the conservation request for residents but kept the boil advisory in place, and they established several distribution sites for bottled water and a laundry additive that people can use in their laundry to keep clothing from discoloring. So in a matter of hours, you had a situation that escalated pretty dramatically. In fact, at about 9 p.m. on Wednesday, the Montgomery County Sheriff's Office asked residents to not call 911 with questions about the water emergency because the regional dispatch center was flooded with calls.
How many people were impacted by this at the height?
At the height of the water emergency, you had potentially hundreds of thousands of residents affected in Dayton and Montgomery County, which has Montgomery County alone has 535,000 residents or just over that. So now with the containment, you have just a few communities still under the boil advisory. At 10 a.m. this morning, the city lifted their boil advisory for the city proper, but it still stands for about 15,000 to 20,000 residents in Montgomery County.
Do they have any idea what caused the break?
In the 8 a.m. press conference on Thursday morning, they talked a lot about infrastructure and aging pipes in the system. So that is kind of the assessment that they're going with now until they can get in there and actually look at the damage and do the repairs, because the water level is so high right now from all the rain that they can't even get in to repair the system yet.
But right now the assumption appears to be just an old pipe.
Correct.
All right, Jerry, we'll keep an eye on it for you. Thanks for calling in today.
Oh, sure. Thank you, Michael.
All right, we'll talk to you again soon.
All right.
All right, so that was Jerry from WYSO, Jerry Kenny, talking about the water situation in Dayton and Montgomery County. We're going to be talking more about infrastructure at the local level coming up on the back half of this show. But before that, we want to get the latest on FC Cincinnati and its stadium's potential impact on the Cincinnati Ballet. Joining us in the studio, our Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Sharon Coolidge and Inquirer columnist Jason Williams. Welcome to you both.
Hello. Weren't we just here talking about this?
We were indeed. And if you want to join us, call us 513-419-7100. We get your call on the air. You can email talk@wvxu.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter and leave some comments and tweets. We'll be looking for those as well. All right. So, Sharon, like you just said, we had John last week, and the situation seemed to be more of a chaotic one with multiple pieces needing to be addressed at that point. But it's been 7 days. Have some pieces of this puzzle been put back together?
Not some of them, but not enough to get the work started on the stadium. And that's really the biggest issue here. You know, there was a lot of questions about this land deal with the team, and that did get worked out. The city has, I don't want to use the word sold, because it's really like a lot of swaps.
It's a
and
swap
paying. And, you know, it's not a giveaway of the land. A lot of exchanges there. And that we had a unanimous vote at City Council on that this week. But that left an outstanding issue of whether the council should approve zoning for the stadiums. No zoning, no building.
Okay, so that's been delayed for now. But there's also an agreement with the team in Music Hall after some problems?
Honestly, so City Council has been asked to weigh in on two things. Should we sell this piece, this crucial piece of land that the team needs? The answer ended up being yes. And should they change the zoning? Those are really the only two issues before council. But there's all these ancillary issues, and council members have an interest in them. And they were, you know, basically holding their votes until some of these things got worked out. And there's a myriad of, like, who wants what? And so Music Hall was something that was a very concerning to some of the council members. That did get worked out. Like, how impactful would the noise be on the noise from the stadium be on Music Hall should they have performances at the same time? And so, but we ended up seeing an agreement where everybody's like, well, it's not really the company's main performing time. There's not going to be a lot of overlap. We're going to work together, schedule things together. And we're going to deal with this. And like, everybody's happy with the agreement to deal with it.
So Jason, what can you tell us about just where we stand at this point? What should the community know about where we are and what happens moving forward?
Well, right now,
that's all right.
Thanks for having me. So right now it stands at the Ballet and FC Cincinnati are in talks about their site. And I think Sherry could probably speak to this better than I could, but the Ballet wants to move. And so there's discussions about that. And if FC Cincinnati would help them to do that.
If there's Ballet people listening, they're going to say they don't want to move. They want to coexist, and that might mean expanding to another location too, or, you know, just continuing on as they are and having the stadium built around what their lease allows them to. Everybody knows that is not the best solution, though. But, you know, publicly they are saying that we'll just coexist and we'll go along how we are. But council's like, come on, everybody. For some of these council members, we're not going to vote until you both work out. Everybody has to be happy. And we left council where nobody was happy. there's been a lot of talks going on, I know, between the team and the Ballet, but we're not there yet.
It's difficult to follow for me where the council members stand on this issue in general, the issue of just the team and its soccer stadium and where it's going. So this vote on what we're, I guess, characterizing as a land swap on Wednesday was unanimous. But then there are other issues, or there were previous issues. There may be other forthcoming issues. Can you break down where the city's elected officials stand just in general on this?
Honestly, it's one of the, because we're using these ancillary issues about whether you can vote for zoning, it's very hard to say where they all stand. Because there's another issue, too, besides the Ballet that some council members are interested in resolving. And that is a tenant whose lease had expired in one of the buildings that was demolished that the team purchased and demolished. Her lease basically was not renewed. She was a tenant. And so the team is like, well, we paid the owner for his building. And she had to go because her lease was up. They said, but it's all optics. You know, the team said, we're not displacing anyone. And we have a Black restaurateur build her business from scratch in the West End. And, you know, the community is like, you are displacing her. And the team's like, not really. And so there's a lot of things. So the team did give her $20,000. They didn't have to do that. But like, there's like an obscure city thing that talks about like moving people, and that's the most somebody would get. And so the team did agree to do that. But some council members were like, hey, you know, we want her to be happy. Can you make her happy? Then maybe we'll vote for your zoning. And so some council members are like, I want to see what happens with the ballet. Some people are like, I want to see what happens with this restaurateur, and can she get happy? And there's all kind of things on the table for her. There's all kind of discussions with the ballet. And so you have to go down the nine, and it's like, who cares about what? Amy Murray said it, she is for this. If it was up to her, we would have voted as it was on the agenda on Wednesday, and she would have voted yes. I think she's basically the only one kind of going into the room where we knew that was going to be the case. And so now we've kind of shaken out of like, and she's like, so where does everyone stand? And it's like, well, everyone talked and we're trying to sort it out. And it ended up just getting delayed. But I think for P.G. Sittenfeld, really, you know, he's kind of like taken a lead, working on all the negotiations on this. He wants things to be resolved with the ballet. And I think that's why it's taken the center stage.
Yeah. And I want to bring him up. Jason, you wrote a column last week arguing that this whole situation gives Councilman Sittenfeld the opportunity to prove that he's capable of being the next mayor of Cincinnati. In the days since you wrote that, what's your assessment of his performance?
So it's been a lot of behind-the-scenes things, and he has the relationships with the arts community, probably better relationships there than anyone else on council and maybe anyone at City Hall. I will say he's been working it pretty hard. I think there's still, it's an incomplete grade right now. Let's see what happens with the vote. And I think there's a lot of hand-wringing still going on behind the scenes. There's a faction of people who think this is a shakedown effort, an extraction effort for the ballet and the restaurant to try to get money or more money out of FC Cincinnati. Or there's another faction of people who say that's not what this is all about at all. It's just about trying to be good neighbors and work together and work out some of the kinks in the, being good neighbors and partnerships. And so it's, as Sherry talked about and went into detail, it's overall, it's a very complex ordeal, multiple layers. There are questions, I think, still lingering. Should City Hall even be involved in this? Well, the ballet asked City Hall to be involved. FC Cincinnati, essentially, the moment they came asking for taxpayer money last year, involved city council. So I know there are people out there who think they shouldn't be involved, but so be it. I mean, that they've invested $34 million into the stadium, they being the stewards of taxpayer money. And so they're very much involved. And, at the end of the day, I think we could sit here and argue about this and wring our hands about it. But, this is, again, my opinion is that I think that all this stuff should have been worked out a year ago or not a year ago, but, 6 months ago, last summer, last spring. And so this is where we're at, and we're doing our typical Cincinnati thing, and we're fighting over a big development.
That seems to be a position that Sittenfeld made clear at City Hall earlier. He was quoted as saying, someone didn't plan as well as they should have planned or been as proactive as they should have been. That was about the zoning vote, I believe, or possibly.
He did point that out. And his point was, this is the first time council's hearing about it, this is the first time it's come before us. And he's like, so, don't say we're delaying things. We just started technically discussing it. But these issues have been out there. And if we want to look at the blame, we can go back. I mean, it's like the timeline of how this all happened. It's like, well, to get, this was our year to get the expansion team. If we're going to do it, we have to get a stadium. So now we're on a tight timeline for that. Now we get the stadium. Now where it's going to go, we're on a tight timeline for that. And so you can kind of go back to Major League Soccer demanding a stadium and where are we going to put it in an urban core, which is what they were requesting if we were going to do this. And council did say, with this infrastructure vote, we want Major League Soccer here. They couldn't have been more excited. Kevin Flynn shouted the word goal and everybody clapped. And that was a good moment for the city. This, Carl Lindner, the owner of the team, and these other owners are bringing a $250 million development because this is the opponents, right? So council's like all these other people, right? But there were a lot of people at City Hall who were trying to point out, this is a $250 million development. It's the biggest development in the city in decades. We had builders, electricians coming in, and we're supposed to be working on this. These are our jobs. And so they came in and they were making those points, which was the flip side. And this is a tough one. But if you want to say, I think some of the council members are like, it's not my fault. It's kind of like the underlying thing there. There's a lot of things to go around of how this all came to be. It's not just one person, one entity of where how we got to this point.
So Chris Wetterich over at the Business Courier, he wrote this week that the unanimous vote at City Hall this week related to like the land swap, he said it followed, quote, an intense week of backroom meetings and arm twisting with incredible political pressure brought to bear by some of Cincinnati's richest citizens who either have interest in the club or the arts organizations at Music Hall. Jason, is that a fair characterization of what was going on?
Absolutely. I couldn't have said it any better. He said it very well there, and that's a perfect characterization of what's been going on.
So who are these rich players?
It's your standard, a lot of names that you hear, the people who are on the board of the ballet and who are on the board of Music Hall and, you know,
Otto Buttig is
the biggest name you hear.
He came to council. He was in chambers on Wednesday. Jeff Birding is the team president. He was on the telephone with the people who own the team, and we're talking about Carl Lindner III. And so, you know, these people were interacting with what was going on in the interest of the things that they champion and, you know, patron. And their money is very important to these things continuing in our community, their donations.
Whose family's given millions to Music Hall, the Lindner family.
Yeah, so they're kind of on both sides of the coin. They're big, big investors in the team, of course, and then big givers
certainly
to
we're,
the
certainly
arts.
The Lindner family's on the side of Music Hall. I'm not sure the Lindner family's involved in the ballet.
There are more Music Hall people. Yeah. We had a very funny moment this week. So on Monday, after everything, all the wrangling and everything at Budget Committee, and the vote gets delayed, and they're talking about everything, this jersey unveil for the team is. And so, you know, that's like it, that's at Music Hall.
Right.
Kind of
the
pre-planned.
Great
and Carl Lindner is on stage. The timing was impeccable. He goes, how ironic that we're here in Music Hall tonight to unveil our jerseys. Pause. Laughter from like just tons of fans were packed into the room. They wanted to see what the jersey looked like. It was the first time that everyone was going to see it. And he's like, because my mother is the donor and the grand foyer is like named after her. And he didn't say anything about city council or the hall or the fight about noise. It was a good moment.
So we've got these major players in Cincinnati's cultural institutions. We either have them as part of a major sports team or major arts organizations. But there is a neighborhood as well. And you kind of referenced some of the smaller entities.
That's Tamaya Denard, and she's against all of this, the councilwoman. She was pretty clear where she stood. And she's like, nobody cared about noise until the Music Hall supporters came in here. And she's like, because I got a neighborhood full of people who will care about the noise.
Do they? I mean, what is the reaction and the perspective of just the rank and file people in the neighborhood, the small business owners and the residents? Is there still some bad blood there?
You know, I don't actually, I mean, some people say that there is bad blood. I don't really see that. The community council approved it. The team has been working, keeping them in the loop at all stages. If you go to a community council meeting in the West End, you might see things first. This is something new at the stadium. There's a community benefits agreement. And so they are really working together. But of course, I think if you live there, you would be concerned because you don't know. The team, you know, they're still building the stadium. They're looking at noise barriers and canopies, and they promised to work on it. It's still a Major League Soccer stadium, and it's being built in a neighborhood. So I think we don't really know the answers. And the team has promised to be a good partner, so we're going to kind of see how that plays out. But when we were talking about the noise, it was, that's just one concern, and we'll work with the neighbors. But when Music Hall said we're concerned about the noise, we might have delayed the vote. But that was Tamaya's point anyway.
We had a former city council member weigh in this week with an op-ed at the Cincinnati Inquirer, Kevin Flynn. He wrote the op-ed. He accused city council of playing games, I guess. What was his message, Jason?
Well, his message was that he thinks this is a government overreach, that City Hall, City Council should not be involved in this at all, that these are disputes between two private organizations, FC Cincinnati and the ballet, FC Cincinnati and the restaurant Just Cooking, and the government should stay out of it, let those private entities deal with whatever issues they may have, and so be it. I did find one thing intriguing in that op-ed is that he likened this ordeal to the Children's Hospital vote of, August of 2017.
Where they wanted to expand into a neighborhood, Avondale.
Which was an expansion that's double the amount of money that the stadium actually is. You know, I think there's, again, two schools of thought on that, and I kind of go back and forth on it. I'm not seeing the direct compare. You know, I think the overall thought from some people is that there's an anti-development vibe at City Hall among the majority of council progressives. That's certainly legitimate. Overall, though, I see these as two different developments in that Children's didn't ask for anything from City Hall. They didn't ask for one dime in taxpayer money, whereas the FC Cincinnati did. And Children's worked out their entire deal on their own. And all they needed was a zoning, essentially a rubber stamp deal. And that's not what FC Cincinnati's wanted. So,
and I want to break down, because we had to do this last week as well, is that you hear from the FC Cincinnati, the organization, saying that this is a private effort to get this constructed. But, Jason, there is a substantial public investment as well.
Absolutely. $34 million just from City Hall. You've got $4 million from the state. You've got the county building garages. I don't know what that total is at right now.
There's no... It's no definitive. Possibly like 23, 24 million is a preliminary number we've seen.
Okay. Well, let's go to the phones. We've got Jeannie on Cincinnati Edition. What would you like to say?
I would just like to say, with the noise and music hall, but they're building a stadium. Didn't they say they were going to build it with a dome?
You know, a lot of people have said that. Because if you see renderings, you can see it has like a kind of a half canopy, and that is definitely for noise issues, but it is not a full dome. That is so expensive. Like, because there's been years people have been like, the Bengals stadium should be domed, and like, those numbers are just crazy numbers. It's impossible to do. And so there's never been a dome. It just seems like there's like a half canopy.
But Jeannie, now, as I understand, and Sherry, again, has done tremendous coverage on this, they've changed that design, and now that even that little partial roof canopy thing is not even going to be on.
Yeah, that was one of the pieces that was scaled back, I think Chris mentioned last week. Was that the orange, some of the orange piece that was being pulled back?
The canopy that really essentially wraps the entire stadium, that really goes over, I guess, the upper deck seating.
No, that's still there. It was more like the lighting was kind of a change. And honestly, this stadium is not designed. Like, we asked a lot of questions, because when they brought it through committee, I mean, the idea for zoning is, you know, 30% planned, and what does that plan look like? And we saw some changes, and like 30%, like there's a lot of things morphing. Like, how much is the team spending? We're not going to, I think March 25th is the date where we're going to see, you know, the final go through planning commission final. But, and one of the reasons why council is so concerned right now, this is the last time council gets to weigh in. It's just how the process works. It seems kind of crazy that they only get to weigh in at the 30% mark, but it will again come through planning commission for approval. But I think that we haven't really seen what this really is going to look like.
Sandy joins us next. You're on Cincinnati Edition. What's your question, Hello. Sandy?
Well, I know that you brought this up. I've been listening to this for days, for hours, on your statement, but why in the world was all of this not ironed out way before we got this far into it? Why did the stadium have to be an urban stadium? We've got a lot of property in Hamilton County where a stadium could have been built without interruption to a neighborhood, to the arts, to anything else. Why did we agree to an urban stadium?
Thanks for your call, Sandy. Jason, you want to take that one?
Well, that was Major League Soccer's edict that they really want to have as a part of their philosophy, is to really, they think, to draw younger fans, is they really want to have stadiums in urban redeveloped areas where you can, you know, where a lot of younger adults and professionals are live or are moving back into redeveloped condos and apartments. And so they really want to try to latch on to those, that energy in a lot of these cities that they're in right now.
And we got a comment from Maxine. She says, council is spending so much time on this. When are they going to spend time on the local poverty issues? And before I let you all go, in another column, Jason, you concluded that FC Cincinnati will get its stadium, but it might not be on its schedule. Is that still the case?
Well, it could be, but here's what I think is going to happen is City Council is going to give the entities a week here to talk about it, and they're going to come back and they're going to vote to approve the zoning. I almost think regardless of whatever comes of these negotiations. And so I think that's what we're going to see.
We're on a timeline to open March 2021. That's the apparently in the contract. They said the construction officials during public comment said the delay has cost them $500,000. People are not at work right now. It is crunch. They were begging for the vote. You could tell, and it was a lot of frustration because they have to start pouring the foundation to stay on the timeline, and you can't do that unless you have the zoning.
Jason Williams and Sharon Coolidge from the Cincinnati Inquirer, thank you both for joining us today. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
We'll see if it's next week if you're back talking about soccer again.
Hey, congratulations on the new job. You're doing a great job. And well deserved. I know you've worked really hard and with building the River City News into what it is, so congrats.
I appreciate that very much, Jason. Thank you so much. Very kind of you. And up next, potholes, mudslides, what's going on with the region's infrastructure? That's next as our Friday news review continues on Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We saw widespread pothole and mudslide problems impacting traffic across the region this week. What's the deal? Is there a fix? Let's discuss it now with WCPO reporter Pat LaFleur and Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Hannah Sparling. Welcome to you both.
Hey, Michael.
Thanks.
And if you're listening and you've got something to say about potholes and mudslides and landslides and traffic problems across the region, we want to hear from you, too. Give us a call at 513-419-7100. You can also email talk@wvxu.org or look us up on Facebook or Twitter. We'll be looking for your tweets and your comments and try to get some into the show. So let's start by breaking down one of the biggest issues that happened this week, Columbia Parkway and landslides or mudslides or whatever you're calling it. It was such a big deal. It was actually like one of the top local trends on Twitter. So Everyone was weighing in on the Columbia Parkway situation. Just recap, Hannah, the last several days on that very important stretch of road.
So basically, it's just been, it seems almost every day or a couple times a day in some cases, there's whatever you want to call it, a mudslide or a landslide, something from the hillside falls down on the road. It blocks
earth
traffic.
Movement.
Earth movement is what
that's
they
the phrase that CPD
it.
Keeps using. I
okay.
Think.
Yeah, that was interesting.
Yeah.
And it shuts down traffic at least one way, sometimes two ways during rush hour. It annoys a lot of people. And you kind of wonder, like, what are we going to do about this long term? Because there's a lot left up there that could fall down.
And not to mention, this is a major artery. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's prone to traffic problems anyway. It's kind of dangerous. A lot of accidents happen on that stretch. It's heavily trafficked. And then when it's closed, you've got some serious problems.
Yeah, it's kind of a road that you hate when it's open, but you really miss it when it's not.
That's a good way to put it, I'd say.
So let's call it earth movement then, if that's the official thing that the Cincinnati Police
that's
Department
was That's what I keep seeing
saying.
Them use this week.
That's
I hadn't
new
seen it
this
before.
Week, though,
yeah. Police language can be very difficult to translate into English, but earth movement, if that's what's happening, what's causing it? What's the problem?
Well, I think part of the problem began back almost 100 years ago when they first built the parkway. They cut it about halfway up that very large hill that runs up to Mount Adams and the surrounding neighborhoods. And engineers pretty much all agree now that was probably a pretty bad place to put that road, at least geotechnically, as far as the grade of the hill. Another problem is that the wall that they built just clearly isn't tall enough to hold back the earth that it's supposed to hold. So it really is an engineering problem that dates back decades.
I think it's also just a problem with our earth here. Our soil is, it turns out, not great. It's kind of weak sauce soil. And it just, when it takes on a lot of rain, it just slides easily.
How do they explain that? What I mean, just naturally, that's
yeah,
sort of the situation?
The shale formation that we're on, it's just kind of weak, and it turns into clay really easily, which slides.
Well, and heavy rain downpours and just heavy precipitation events are getting more and more frequent. So where a decade ago we would see a certain amount of rain in a month, now we're starting to see that amount of rain in just a couple days. And so especially when you've got the snow melt factor kind of hardening that top layer of soil, kind of separates, and this is all one of our meteorologists was informing me about this earlier, and it kind of creates this perfect situation for the top layer of soil to just slide away with just an afternoon's worth of rain.
So you referenced that some geotechnical experts have suggested that perhaps this wasn't the best location for a major artery in the area. Why was it placed there then? Was this something that they didn't know at the time?
There was already a road there. It was called Columbia Avenue, I think, and it was mostly dirt. And I'm not really super familiar with the road network and the grid at the time, back in the 20s and 30s. But somehow the political forces aligned to decide that this dirt road would become a major paved roadway to connect downtown with the more residential east side neighborhoods.
And I think we used to be less concerned with how we cut into hillsides. Kind of, oops, now we know we shouldn't have done that.
There's a lot of hillside regulations now that maybe didn't exist before. Yeah. And producer Pete Reitmeier tells me that it was a WPA project for that original wall that's over there. So has anyone suggested, if we had it to do over, what we would have done, where we would have placed this road?
I've never asked where they would do it differently. I have asked, you know, what do we do now? And the city seems to, at least as far as I've heard from them, that they're kind of in the constant monitoring phase. Mm-hmm. But I have not heard anything about some sort of long-term fix for this.
I mean, one obvious fix is to make the wall higher.
Right.
But yeah. That's...
Is that a city project then, or is that something that they would be eligible for some other type of funding source?
I believe the wall itself would be a city works project.
They could certainly apply for grants.
Right. Yeah. And the road itself is US 50, so that's a federally owned roadway. But often the municipalities manage the upkeep of those roads that run through their cities.
Hannah, one of your articles on this subject this week had the headline posing the question, is this the new normal?
Mm-hmm.
Is it?
I think so. I mean, if climate change goes the way scientists say it's going to, we're going to get wetter winters, we're going to get more rain, and the hills just can't handle that, so they're going to slide down.
But maybe a larger wall would be able to withstand
this? A larger wall would catch more of that, yeah.
Yeah, I think it would catch more of the dirt. I don't know that it would necessarily solve the larger hillside slippage problem. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure how, you know, it might be a case where we would need to keep making the wall higher over time, and I'm not sure how sustainable that is long term.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's anything we can do to stop landslides from happening here unless we just level the city.
The city of Seven Hills.
I want to state that is not my idea.
You're not taking a position on leveling Cincinnati on our program
today.
I'd
like to not do that.
We're talking with Pat LaFleur from WCPO and Hannah Sparling from the Cincinnati Inquirer. We're talking about infrastructure, mudslides, rain slides, earth movement, and other problems on the highways and some traffic. If you've got concerns or comments or questions, give us a call at 513-419-7100. We'll take your call on the air. You can also email talk@wvxu.org to offer a comment or look us up on Facebook or Twitter and contact us there. Pat, you also wrote this week, don't expect landslides on Columbia Parkway to stop anytime soon. What have you discovered in your reporting on this that makes you such a pessimist?
Well, this has been an issue for... an ongoing issue for years and years. It was more than a decade ago when some research I found had been done that the U.S. Geological Survey basically identified Hamilton County as the most costly area in the country per capita for hillside slippage damage. I haven't been able to get updated statistics from them about, you know, where that most costly area might be or if that moniker still applies to Hamilton County. But this has clearly been an issue for a long time. And I would say that any pessimism that I've conveyed probably is rooted in how difficult it is or it seems for this region generally to implement big long-term improvements to its infrastructure. It's always such a long process, and that's just kind of the nature of some of these projects. But if other examples give me any indication, we might be waiting for a while for this.
And what was the what has the impact been on some of the side streets? Because when the road is shut down, you got to go somewhere else. And there's not a lot of options coming from that side of town without zigzagging through different neighborhoods. So what has the impact been on those streets and those neighborhoods? And are people concerned there long term if this becomes a regular occurrence?
I think if it's a day or two, it's annoying for that day or two, and then it's fine. If they did have to shut it down to do some kind of long-term fix, that's when we would really see some frustration, I think, in those neighborhoods and maybe some more damage on those roads.
Have we noticed which parts of town or which streets in that area tend to be more heavily impacted when Columbia Parkway is shut down?
Well, I would say that Riverside Drive probably gets a lot of runoff traffic, pardon the pun, runoff. But the road down the hill from Columbia Parkway, and you know, instinctively you would think, well, wouldn't they be suffering from the same problems there? They are generally, but more often on Riverside Drive, you hear from property owners down there who are seeing slippage into their property. But the road itself tends to remain open. The problem is, as opposed to Columbia Parkway being five lanes across, Riverside Drive is two lanes across.
Two, I think it's 35 miles an hour.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, and it's got bike lanes down there, so it's not really the best option for high volume throughput for automobiles. Having used to work out in that area, I can personally attest to how backed up Riverside Drive can get just from one lane of Columbia Parkway being shut down.
Well, let's go to the phones. We've got Zach. You're on Cincinnati Edition.
Hi, yeah. I'm actually calling. I lived on both the east and the west side. I'm calling actually in regards to see if the city is looking into the hillside on Elberon Avenue on the other side of 50 West. I drive that every day, and I seem to notice every day the hill is getting closer and closer to the road. It's starting to mound up. Some of the retaining walls that they've actually already built are actually getting blown out by the hillside.
Great question, Zach. Thanks for the call. Any of you have the answer to that?
Well, so some info I got from the city was that they seem to have two high priority areas where this happens. One of them is Columbia Parkway and the other is Elberon on the west side. So to the caller's question, that is definitely on the city's radar. As far as what that means they're doing proactively versus maybe just reacting to moments of slippage and lane blockages, I don't have a clear answer on that.
The impression I got also was that it's an area they're watching, but other than that, I'm not sure.
All right,
what's going on?
Braden, you're next on Cincinnati Edition. Hey, Braden, are you there? We got a question or a comment for us?
Yeah, I've heard a lot of this discussion about landslides, and I'm pretty familiar with a lot of the vegetation around here. And one of the things I haven't heard come up in the discussions is how honeysuckle has shallow-rooted roots and really doesn't hold the hillsides. There are a lot of our native trees, such as hickories, and walnuts have deep tap-rooted roots that will drive into the bedrock and help stabilize some of the top layers of soil, which really just comes in as managing the honeysuckle to eliminate it to get some of the native vegetation with more diversity of roots to help stabilize the hillsides. But I haven't really heard that discussion come up in some of these discussions around stabilizing the hillsides. So.
Cool. Great comment. Braden, thanks for the call. Have you all heard anything on addressing it through vegetation?
Yeah, I would guess that would go into what you were talking about earlier, Hannah, with just some structural problems with the soil itself. And
maybe.
I'm no botanist, though, so I'm not going to pretend to be an expert on how that works. But I know that honeysuckle is a huge problem just in this whole region as far as an invasive species goes.
Yeah, well, we see what right there at the cut in the hill in Covington, the hillside there on the, I guess that would be the east side of 7175, that the vegetation there, which looks really lovely and lush now, it deals with a lot of the water runoff. So I guess Braden raises an interesting point. Let's continue on the phones now. We've got Adam on the line. You're on Cincinnati Edition. Adam, what's your question or comment?
Hi, my name is Adam. I'm an excavating contractor in the area, and I just wanted to add to what the panelists have said about the slip or the hillside earth movement, what they're calling it. A lot of the problem does go back to what one of the panelists had said on the shale being an issue, not being stable in the groundwork. But I think a lot of the slips that we have in this area could be fixed by changing our best practices, meaning like
the rules and regulations regarding how fills are put in and how hillsides are cut have changed over the years, but they're still not where they need to be, I believe, especially for the challenges that Cincinnati area possesses.
Great comment, Adam. We appreciate the call very much. If you want to weigh in, 513-419-7100, email talk@wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. So it wasn't just Columbia Parkway this week. Hannah, you reported on a study about the worst bottlenecks in the country. The study comes out every year. I've seen it before. And it's not the first time that 71 and 75, where they collide there at the Bryn Spence Bridge, has ended up on this list for the worst bottlenecks in the nation. Mm-hmm. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I think we were at number 6 in the nation. And this was just, it was a study looking at just trucks. So trucks trying to get through Cincinnati and just getting stuck. And so it turns out, as we know, if you ever try to drive on 75, you know you get stuck there. They're just getting stuck there for longer than in a lot of other states, and it's costing a lot of money, I think, for trucking companies.
So they're saying it's the 6th most congested for trucking companies anywhere in the country.
Mm-hmm.
So what do we know about proposed solutions to this logjam at this point?
I'm not familiar with any.
I don't think there are any.
I mean, this is the Bryn Spence Bridge corridor.
You know, the ongoing debate over whether we need to build a bridge next to it.
And it doesn't seem that there's anything new. And there hasn't been anything new for some time on that issue. Have you heard anything?
No, I've not heard anything new about it. You know, other than the cost to build a supplemental bridge just keeps
going
continuing.
Up.
Yeah, growing, what was it, like 8 million additional a month? Or
yeah, it's something crazy nuts. Like, and then how we're going to pay for it is obviously the most controversial part. I think there tends to be more agreement on whether the project is necessary, although that's not unanimous either. But mm-hmm. in terms of, fine, we need it, but we're not paying for it with user fees or tolls.
Well, so that was kind of a new thing, I think, with Mike DeWine's inauguration. There was some sort of hint that Governor Matt Bevin in Kentucky might be more willing to work with Mike DeWine in Ohio, even maybe including tolls, which
both have said that tolls would be on the table. I think both governors are in favor of tolls, but they're off the table in Kentucky right now.
They're by law, by legislation. They are not allowed.
Legislation that I believe Bevin had a hand in, or at least he campaigned.
Well, Northern Kentucky legislators certainly did, and it is a piece of legislation that spans connecting Kentucky to Cincinnati. So they were quite specific on how they were blocking tolls from moving forward. You know, when supporters of the Bryn Spence Bridge project talk about moving forward and expanding the highway, some opponents of just the project in general take the tolls out. They counter this by saying that expanding highways doesn't ease congestion. Has either of you found that to be true in your reporting? Either of you know anything about that?
There's a common concept called induced demand. It comes out of economic theory. But the idea is that if you put more lanes on our highways, that's just going to mean more people will find their way to driving in those lanes.
And then we need more lanes.
Right. And there are academic studies that have shown as much as a one-to-one correlation between adding a new lane and basically getting a full lane's worth of new traffic on that roadway. So there is some merit to the concern that expanding or widening the Bryn Spence corridor, including maybe a new bridge, would not really solve the problem. It would just kind of
make a wider problem.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, or cut about 45 seconds off your commute, some mm-hmm. people would argue, and is that worth it, considering the cost of it?
Right.
And we should note that of all the talk of Governor Matt Bevin in Kentucky and Governor Mike DeWine in Ohio possibly being able to come together on this, that was also the case for Governor John Kasich and Governor Steve Beshear before them. They actually mm-hmm. came to town multiple times with a deal that said, all we need is your support and we're going to be able to get this done. And it was rejected on the Northern Kentucky side.
I think I covered one of those press conferences for you, Michael.
I think you may have back in the old days. Yep. Good time that was. In addition to roads, we've also had to write and report a lot lately about pedestrian issues. Mm-hmm. And we've had a string of tragedies and injuries involving pedestrians. I believe there was going to be an announcement on Friday out of Cincinnati City Hall. I'm not exactly sure what that was about.
There was a press conference at 11 this morning where John Cranley and Chris Seelbach announced a task force to study pedestrian connectivity, specifically in downtown. So downtown wasn't necessarily a hotspot for some of these tragic cases that we've been seeing in the news. But this was kind of a collaboration with, especially with Kroger, since they have their headquarters down there and they're building this new tower a block away that will have a new grocery store in it and apartments and other things. They really want to invest in the Court Street area specifically and make it easier for people to walk from over the Rhine down to the banks and back and just make it more connected, I think, is the idea.
So pedestrian safety has kind of dominated some of the conversations in our local halls, our city hall, our city buildings and county buildings. Anything else coming from this? Or are we at least learning that there is a situation?
I think people are more and more aware. There's a lot of talk about this idea called Vision Zero, which is basically just trying to make it so that nobody gets hit while they're crossing the street. And that would require, that's a nice saying. Obviously, it would require some policy changes, some enforcement changes, some things like that to make it actually happen.
Okay. And Pat, you wrote this week about something involving a bike trail situation in Northern Kentucky. What's the latest going on over there?
Yeah, so it's a, there's a group that's been around for years called Tri-State Trails, and they do trail work all over the region. They are now soliciting proposals from the Northern Kentucky communities for how to make those three top counties in Northern Kentucky, the three northernmost counties, how to make them more connected through things like bike trails, bike lanes, just walking trails, any sort of active transportation mode. And their goal here is rather than, this as far as I understand it, rather than building a vision and then trying to sell it to the Northern Kentucky communities, they're basically just asking the Northern Kentucky communities, what do you want? Where do you want to see a bike lane? Where do you want to see a new trail path, et cetera? So it's a pretty humble project. I think the group will only be able to provide about $30,000 toward a project. So this is going to require a lot of private money coming from some of these people, depending on the project. But it's meant to be a jump starter and a conversation starter.
You're a bike rider, and you live in Northern Kentucky, so you commute by bike to Cincinnati. Just very quickly, because we're short on time in about 30 seconds, what's the condition of bike access in Northern Kentucky? Is it good? Is it bad? Is it improving?
I would say it takes practice, and it's not going to feel comfortable for everyone right away to ride their bike through Northern Kentucky just because the infrastructure isn't there yet.
Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Hannah Sparling and WCPO reporter Pat LaFleur, thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
For
thanks.
Coming on today to talk to us. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. And the technical director is Josh Elstrow. Archives of our program can be found online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.